Welcome to Linux Link Radio by TimeSys, a podcast for embedded Linux developers.
Hi, this is Gene Sally. I'm with TimeSys. We're really fortunate today. We have Thomas Gleisner with us, who's done a lot of work on the real-time extensions that had been folded into the 2.6 kernel mainline. I don't know how many folks are out there that need or watch the real-time market and with respect to Linux, but there's been great advancements into making a lot of that open source opposed to some of the proprietary solutions that are out there. So for this format, what we wanted to talk about today was what's in there and what is real-time. We have a lot of folks that get in touch with us and say, hey, Gene, I'm looking for a real-time system. I need it to be really fast. And sort of immediately the red flag goes up. I think to myself, well, it's not really fast. And I know Thomas, we were talking, even before we were getting ready, I was talking to Thomas about this. And he was like, yeah, a lot of people do have that misconception. So
yeah, it's a common misconception. It's widespread over engineers, so yeah. Real time has to be fast. No, yes, it has to be fast, but only as fast as specified, not as fast as possible. Doug Niehaus, professor at Kansas University, made this statement a couple of years ago, and I think it describes exactly where the problem is. People try to say, we need real time because it has to be fast. Mm-hmm. Yes, but it has to be fast, but only as fast as specified. So you meet the deadline, so it becomes deterministic. That's the main point.
Oh, so okay. So because I know when I talk to people, I say almost the same thing. It's like, well, you're really looking for behavior within a certain, some action within a certain interval.
Yes.
And I know the next thing that we always get is, well, will it work within n many microseconds on Y processor? That's another. It's an entirely reasonable question because people have this certain goal, like they have something to measure. They have some factory thing that they need to turn on and off. Or they have some data stream coming in, and it's always sort of tough to give those people an answer that they want.
Yes, it is hard due to a couple of factors. Back then, when we were talking about real time on microcontrollers, it was very easy because you looked at the data sheet and exactly knew. The interrupt service routine will be entered exactly n clock cycles after the hardware signal happened. Mm-hmm. On modern CPUs, there is no guarantee for this. There are too many factors which influence this. We have caches. We don't know if the interrupt service routine code is actually in a cache line. If it is not, it has to be reloaded from memory. We have DMA, which might block the processor bus for a certain amount of time, and some other factors around that. So it's really hard to make this pure mathematical decision if it will always happen or not. Because the number of factors is too high to get a precise mathematical model of it. So we can still do this with DSPs, with microcontrollers, but not with the modern all-purpose CPUs. Mm-hmm. But we want to have them in the devices because they provide us networking, they provide us USB or graphics interfaces and things like this. And we want to leverage the computing power of those CPUs, mm-hmm. so we don't have to build two devices, we can build one device. Yeah. If it comes down to extreme latency requirements, it's often you have to think in the hardware design how to achieve this. Yeah. It's often better to put a $3 microcontroller on the same board. Let this microcontroller do this special response time thing, or you have some functionality in an FPGA, which is common. FPGAs or things like this are common on today's boards. So mm-hmm. often you have to think it from the engineering point of view. What can I load off from the main CPU, which makes me it easier to do this time critical thing? So the immediate response might happen in the FPGA, so the main CPU can have a more relaxed real time requirement. Mm-hmm. So that's
pretty clever. I mean, really, what it is it's usually the other way around. You're solving a software problem with hardware, which is
yes. Yeah, because we can't solve the hardware problem, which is inside this modern all-purpose CPU with software. There's no way.
Yeah.
Yes, there are ways, but if we do that, we lose a lot of the functionality of this CPU, and we don't want to do that either.
Yeah. So that's actually a fairly clever approach. So I know probably the folks that are listening want to know. Or put it this way, so we do talk to people, and they really don't understand what is in the real-time patch. I mean, the word real-time means something to them. But when they hear the words real-time patch in Linux, and you ask them, what's in there? You
know, what's in there? Well, it has a couple of components. Some of them have been merged already into the mainline kernel. One of the major components is support for priority inheritance.
Okay.
This is to prevent priority inversion. Let me explain it. You have a high priority process and a low priority process. Mm-hmm. Both have need to access some shared data or hardware resource. Mm-hmm. So you have to serialize the access. That because there's no way that both write at the same time to the to this data structure or to the resource.
Sure.
So you need concurrency controls.
Okay.
Concurrency controls exclude or protect this data structure or protect this hardware resource so that no concurrent access happens.
Yeah, that's why they call mutexes, huh?
Yes, that's mutexes, spin locks. We have a lot of them.
I couldn't spell exclusive, so I'm glad they call them mutexes.
Yeah, it's shorter. And so now what happens? A low priority process comes into the critical region where it actually takes this concurrency control, be it a mutex or a spin lock or whatever, and now it gets preempted by a high priority process, which now gets stuck on this concurrency control because it wants to access the same resource.
So wait a second. So if I understand what's happening is that so these two threads both want the same resource, and what's happening is the lower priority thread has acquired the resource,
right?
It's blocking the high priority thread from is that?
Yes.
Is that okay?
But this is if we are only talking about those two processes. That's nothing bad because the high priority process just waits until the low priority process finishes and frees the resource. But now a third process comes into play. It has mid-range priority. So it will preempt the low priority process for an infinite amount of time, thus is processing, gets scheduled away, and at some time after that, the low priority process gets the CPU again, mm-hmm. finishes the critical reason, frees the resource, so and then the high priority process can run and access this resource.
Oh, okay.
So what happened is a priority inversion because we actually put the priority of the high priority process below the priority of the low priority process, which is bad, because what happens there is unbound latency. We cannot control it because we don't have any idea how many processes where the priority is higher than the low priority process will be runnable at this time.
So just I just want to make sure that so that you're saying what's happening is that this low priority thread has the ball. We'll call it the ball, so to speak.
Yes.
So it has the ball, and then it gets stopped from running by a process that really isn't interested in
right.
in the ball that it's holding.
It's
but wants
totally
something else because it just gets scheduled out. So,
right.
so the scheduler is running and says, "Hey, low priority resource, low priority thread, you need to wait." And what really happens is that the high priority thread is waiting as though it's a low priority thread almost. That's almost what happens. Huh? That
right.
Could,
it gets for it gets for a while. It gets a low priority process.
Yeah.
And that's what's called in computer science priority inversion. So there are a couple of ways to prevent priority inversion. One of those is priority inheritance. What happens is, when the high priority process comes to a stop because it cannot access the resource because the concurrency control is held by the low priority process, then the low priority process immediately inherits the priority of the high priority process up to the point where it frees the resource. And then it goes back to its original priority.
Oh, so you sort of game the system so that the thread that is waiting changes the, or more appropriately, the thread that has the resource now all of a sudden can run in such a way that it can't get interrupted. Or at least it won't get interrupted up into the limits of the waiting thread.
Yes. So it only won't, it will get preempted by something which has higher priority.
Okay.
But nothing which has
lower priority
than the high priority waiting thread.
Uh-huh.
So that way we make sure that on the priority level of the high priority thread, uh-huh. the low priority thread runs to completion of the critical region and frees the resource as fast as possible.
Okay.
So that's the mechanism of priority inheritance.
Uh-huh.
So it inherits the priority of the waiting high priority thread up to the point where it frees the resource.
And then it goes back.
And then it goes back to normal and it's out of the way.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a mechanism we... It's not a new invention. It has been used in operating systems for a long time.
Yeah.
And what's currently in the mainline kernel already is support for priority inheritance, uh-huh. mutexes, in the user space.
Yeah.
The infrastructure we had to build for this in the kernel
uh-huh.
is the base component which we leverage for in-kernel priority inheritance.
Okay.
So that means we have also mutual exclusion devices or mutual exclusion devices and concurrency controls inside the kernel.
Mm-hmm.
And currently, the mainline kernel is not using them. The mainline kernel is prone to priority inversion still.
So, if you have something like a system call, you can still
yes.
you can still get stuck if you're not careful.
Right. So there are a couple of ways how this can happen.
Mm-hmm.
So the real-time preemption patch actually converts the in-kernel concurrency controls to use this priority inheritance infrastructure so that also priority inheritance happens inside the kernel.
Okay.
So we prevent actually priority inversion inside the kernel too.
On the kernel side, okay.
Yes. So then we have the full picture, user space and kernel side protected from priority inversion. This is one part. It's a very important part.
Well, I have one question, because I'm thinking, so as a user, what do I have to do to take advantage of that? I mean, do I have to really change my program? Do I need to set up a special sort of mutex?
Yes. For user space, you have to... you have to configure the pthread mutex you're using for protecting your shared data to have the priority inheritance protocol.
So when I do my create on that, I just need to make sure I pass on the right set of flags and the attributes.
Right. It's a function call. You set the mutex protocol to priority inheritance.
Okay. Well, it's probably been in the, I think it's been in the POSIX specs for, I don't know how long.
Yes, it is there, but so it okay. needs kernel support. So the policy of glibc is they provide the user space support only when the kernel support is available.
Yeah.
Because otherwise it doesn't make sense.
Yeah, I agree, yeah.
So this is one port. Then one source of long latencies in the kernel we identified are interrupt handlers.
Okay.
So to make them preemptable and not interfering with high priority processing, we converted the interrupt handlers to run inside of threads.
Okay.
That means...
Do you mean the top half or the bottom half?
No, the top half.
Okay.
So what happens is the hardware interrupt happens, it still interrupts the running whatever. Yeah. It goes into the kernel, but instead of immediately running the handler code, it just wakes up a thread, which then runs the handler code.
So, and that you make schedulable.
Yes.
Ah.
So I make this schedulable, so I can adjust the priority of this thread,
okay.
and so I can configure my system to have a user space process running with higher priority than most of the interrupts.
Okay.
Because I'm not interested in those interrupts.
So can you do you have? So as a user, can I control which interrupts get what sort of
yes.
handling?
Yes, you can do this from the command line. There are tools to do that.
So if I want to be a smarty pants, I got to like turn down the keyboard if I want to do it.
Yes.
Maybe that's I could try that on some people here, I think. We'll do that for testing. See what they like. No, maybe not. Well, that's really cool.
And then one part I was mainly involved and I was involved in the other parts too, but where I was working on the last 1.5 years is high-resolution timer support.
Well, tell me how that fits in.
Well, if you want to schedule a periodic process or a periodic thread, the current mainline kernel is tick-based. It's based on a periodic tick. It happens. It's configurable. It's either every millisecond or every 4 or every 10 milliseconds. So this is the resolution or the you get for your periodic scheduling.
Just to make sure, so I understand. So a periodic thread is one that runs, that is selected to be runnable every so many interval.
Time okay. Units.
So that's what a period is.
Yes.
Okay, I just want to make sure I understand. So.
Right. So right now, in the mainline kernel, which is based, the timers are based on a kernel internal periodic timestamp.
Okay.
So every 4 milliseconds, the internal time is compared to the timers which were armed from a user space process
uh-huh.
and checked if they already expired or not.
Mm-hmm.
So the accuracy is plus minus plus minus 4 milliseconds.
Which is a lot. I mean, that's
yeah, it can be a lot. It's okay for tons of applications, but if you want to do precise data acquisition
mm-hmm.
based on a time frame, then you don't want to use that.
Yeah.
So there was the requirement to add high-resolution timers.
Mm-hmm.
There have been attempts in the past to provide high-resolution timers for the Linux kernel, but they failed due to a couple of different reasons. There's a write-up on rt.wiki.kernel.org.
Uh-huh.
Which is the, let's say, official home of the real-time preemption patch, where it's explained in detail why it wasn't possible to do it in the old way. So we created a new timer infrastructure inside of the kernel, HR timers, which are still driven by the tick. Uh-huh. But
the tick of what?
The system tick.
Ah, okay.
So we didn't increase the accuracy of the timers, but mm-hmm. we provided the base infrastructure to do high resolution timers on top.
Yeah.
So that's actually hopefully happening right now. Andrew Morton scheduled the high resolution timers, and as a byproduct of high resolution timers, dynamic ticks, mm-hmm. which is more targeted to power saving.
Mm-hmm.
For inclusion into the next kernel 2.6.21. So high resolution timers allow you to schedule a periodic task every 475 microseconds yeah. if your CPU is fast enough.
Yeah, that's, I guess that's one thing.
And if there are actually timer devices which can provide this accuracy.
And that's one of the things I was thinking about. I was listening. It's like, well, it's really nice if you have a high-res timer that's driven by the click of some timer clock, but if you don't have a clock, if you don't have a clock on your CPU or some device that generates ticks,
well, then you can't use it.
Yeah.
You have the prerequisite that there is something which provides accurate time to read out, so that we actually have a precise yeah. notion of what time it is, and some device which can precisely provide this next event.
Yeah. So it sounds like something that you have to do some amount of work per processor?
Yeah, I was mostly working on a generic infrastructure.
Oh, okay.
So that the actual conversion of a specific processor or a processor family
yeah.
is a certain amount of work, but it's rather specific to utilize the devices which are specific to this CPU.
Okay. Yeah, so most of the, well, I guess you've said most of the infrastructure is done. You just have to fill in the template.
Yes.
To correctly handle the timers.
We have to make use of the actual devices which are specific to the CPU or to the CPU family.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, and that makes perfect sense. Based on how it's architected.
Yes, because a lot of attempts have been made to do this before, and they all ended up with a lot of things directly in the architectures, in mm-hmm. the CPU code, which you don't want to avoid. You want to keep that small,
yeah.
and do all the common infrastructure in a separate place
mm-hmm.
because it's shared over all architectures, and Linux has 24 of them, so
yeah.
it makes a huge amount of sense out of the maintaining point of view.
Yeah, it's a lot easier for a board vendor that puts a specialized
yes.
clock to then put that support in there without having to do a ton of engineering.
Right. And the same applies for dynamic ticks. Dynamic ticks is desired for power savings. Right now, if a CPU goes into a deeper power sleep mode, it's mm-hmm. especially interesting for laptops or battery-powered devices, then still this internal periodic tick happens.
Mm-hmm.
But it often happens for nothing because yeah. there's no work.
Mm-hmm.
So it just happens to increment some notion, one more tick happened and does nothing.
Yeah.
so dynamic ticks also have been, there are some architecture-specific implementations, but we want to migrate them over once the generic infrastructure is there. At the moment, when a CPU goes into idle state, which means it can reach a deeper power-saving state,
mm-hmm.
then we pre-calculate when will exactly the next timer happen,
mm-hmm.
which actually has to do work. So we don't wake up every 4 milliseconds to look if there's work.
Oh,
we look up front, uh-huh. oh, it will happen in 350.
Uh-huh.
So we can actually, based on this, depending on the power modes of a CPU. If we know upfront it's going to be in 300, mm-hmm. we can maybe go immediate into a deeper power mode, so the power saving actually will be higher, so which will give a longer battery time.
Yeah, that's wonderful. I mean, for devices.
So it's just a byproduct of the design.
Yeah.
We had this in mind when we came up with the design. We implemented the high resolution timers first because there was customer demand. But we're now the current state is that also this dynamic tick feature is fully functional.
Wow.
And a lot of people are interested in, especially happy are the folks of the OLPC project, you mm-hmm. notice, one laptop per child.
Yeah.
So they actually were a great promoter of the dynamic ticks feature and totally happy that it's going to be there.
Yeah, I mean, any way they can shave off considering their price point. But I mean, if you're still running a battery-powered device in the field, or you have to,
yes.
or weight's a concern. I know for some of our customers, the weight of the device is a great concern. Anything that'll make that device lighter by meaning less battery is definitely something they have a lot of interest in. Fantastic amount of interest.
Sure.
So I guess the other thing that I did want to touch on a little bit is that we always talk about a scheduler and things. Something gets scheduled and. For folks that this may be a little bit elementary, I guess, for some people, but can you talk a little bit about the changes that went into the actual thread scheduler in Linux in order to make this happen?
Well, the thread scheduler didn't change much in course of the real-time preemption patch because it almost fits every need. It's extremely fast. It's O of one.
Mm-hmm.
So it's predictable. We know exactly what time it takes to select the next runnable process.
Yeah. O1, I guess, means what you can. It takes the same amount of time to schedule.
Yes.
A thread, no matter how many are running.
Yes, independent of how many are running or runnable.
Or yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah.
Because running can only be one.
I agree.
They are runnable and waiting to become running.
Yeah.
But we have to pick out one, and we do it based on priorities, but it's a constant amount of time lookup, independent of the number of threads hanging around. There is an order of magnitude more complexity if SMP comes in play. But this is a general problem. It's not related to real time.
Yeah.
It makes real time on SMP is extraordinarily complex. But mm-hmm. even SMP itself is complex. But the SMP support on the Linux kernel in general is in good shape. So we have not only embedded users of real time, there are users which use that actually on 8-way or 64-way machines.
Mm-hmm.
So it's mostly IBM, I think, created a word for that, enterprise real-time. So the real-time efforts in the Linux kernel are not only driven by the embedded industrial space, there's also interest in the enterprise space.
Yeah. You know, I know at least for enterprises, you still have situations where real-time still means as it happens. And so, even though it's starting to go away.
They have a different time scale for that.
That's yes.
But they nevertheless want to have the guarantee that within that time scale some code path gets executed. So I don't know much about the applications, but I can think of transaction servers.
Yes. Yeah, I can imagine anything that has to do with, you know, with predictably booking.
Yes.
Yes,
because you don't want to. One example was brought up in a talk on a conference. So, automated trading mm-hmm. is based on you push out a bid or ask,
mm-hmm.
but most of them get canceled before they actually build a contract.
Mm-hmm.
So if your cancel is delayed by priority inversion for too long, it actually comes to a contract, and so there's things you want to avoid because it's a lot of money involved.
Yeah. So I know we're starting a little bit short on our time. So what are you working on next? I mean, what do you see coming up in the next 6 months to year?
We are gradually merging the bits and pieces of the real-time preemption patch into the mainline kernel. We have the general go to do that from the last year's kernel summit.
Mm-hmm.
This will take a fair amount of time because we carefully take out one feature or one new functionality, bring it into shape so it gets acceptable in the mainline kernel. It goes through review cycles, through testing in Andrew Morton's tree, and finally ends up in Linus Torvalds' tree.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this will keep us busy for the next year.
Well, I guess one of the nice things is that more users will be getting, in essence, real-time features inside of their kernel.
Right.
And so, you know, as you know, a georegular user, or I guess I'm a gene regular user, right? So, how, you know, what kind of benefit will I see from that? Do you think you're going to start to see applications?
Yes, they're actually one of the largest user group right now outside of industrial usage of the real-time preemption patch are folks who are doing hard disk recording,
uh-huh.
video processing.
Oh, I see.
Because there's an open source project, Check.
Mm-hmm.
It's a hard disk recording software where it can do, I think, 48 tracks or something like that, including effect processing and
mm-hmm.
things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's used for real music production, for live recordings, and you don't want to have this sound on the hard, on your recording, which happens if something is not processed in time.
Yeah.
So those folks are happy that those features come in because it makes their life easier.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a non-industrial, maybe also desktop user interest use case.
Because I guess myself, I know we started at the beginning about me turning down the priority of someone's keyboard and mouse, but I would like mine to be higher, so I didn't have to wait all the time. It always bothers me. If nothing else, I expect the mouse to move around. Forget if the rest of the system's not doing anything. I want the mouse to move around. Well, Thomas, it was great. It was great having you, and I'm glad you could spend some time with us.
Yeah.
Tell us what you're up to, and help us, you know, help the, us understand what's inside of the real-time Linux and what's coming up in the next year or so. It sounds really exciting. I think it would be great that, you know, real-time is going to make it into the main kernel, right, and be just another tool for you to have instead of some specialized
right.
Thing there. But we'll see what interesting applications grow up.
Things, in general, things which get into the mainline kernel get better. Because mm-hmm. they get a broader exposure to users,
yeah.
So the quality improves and it gets new features. Yeah, we are happy to provide this.
Well, again, thank you very much.
Welcome.
Thank you very much. Appreciate you again spending time. Oh, and if you have any questions or comments, drop us a line at podcast@timesys.com, podcast. And, of course, you can always visit us. Drop by at timesys.com. And there's a contact us link on there, and you can give us a ring if you like, or drop a line. I think you can reach sales@timesys.com. You'd never believe this, but the sales guys always happy to talk to somebody. And then, again, you know, podcast@timesys.com if you have any questions or comments or follow-up about what we talked about today. If I get something in, oh, we can address it on a future show. I know Thomas is based out of... I know you're in Germany.
Germany, yes.
Whereabouts?
Near the Switzerland border, down south.
Wow, so I'm very jealous. So he's a... So while we might not be able to get Thomas back in to do another recording, we do correspond with him regularly, and we can address your questions that way. So again, thank you, and drop us a line.
This podcast was brought to you by TimeSys. Check out our new site to get free code, discuss, and learn about embedded Linux development. Go to timesys.com today.